Welcome to a brand new episode.
Mike Driscoll, The Python Show.
Hello and welcome to The Python Show. I'm your host, Mike Driscoll, and today I welcome our guest, John Fincher. He's a tutor and mentor at Coding Nomads, and he also contributes to Real Python from time to time. Anyway, welcome to the show, John.
Hey, Mike. Long time, no talk. We haven't talked for a little while.
Yeah, it has been a while.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. So,
thanks so much for joining me, though. I really appreciate it.
Oh, glad to be here.
Let's start off the show by telling us a little bit about your programming journey, like how you got into programming, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So I was lucky enough to be able to be exposed to things in junior high school. So this is in the early, I mean, like 1980, I think, is when these kids from the high school came and they were trying to drum up support for this new computer science, these new computer courses. And they brought this Apple II computer to the junior high school to show off. Nice. And I was enamored by 40 by 40, 16 color, low res graphics on the Apple II because they had this neat little animation that went off. And it was, I was just floored. I was like, this is cool. So as soon as I could, when I got to high school, I started taking coding courses. So we started with Basic and went up to Pascal. And I thought, you know, I thought programming games was going to be the thing I wanted to do because I was I gamed and did stuff and I wanted to write games. And then I found out that writing games is really hard. And that operating systems and databases and compilers or interpreters are really fun. So, I went from there, I did stuff in high school, noodled with it all on my own, went and took computer science in college, and went to two different colleges, and eventually graduated. Out of college, I finally graduated college in 92. I took a couple years off in between for different things. And then, worked a couple jobs. I was a sysadmin for a little while. I worked as a programmer for a little while. Excuse me. And then I got on at Microsoft, in 1995, I think my start date was like 2 weeks after Windows 95 launched. I thought I had applied initially to work on coding, to work on Windows NT 4 and be a network stack programmer. And they thought that I'd be great as a support engineer instead. So, I turned that into a 21-year career at Microsoft. I was a support engineer for a long time. I was a tester, software tester for a long time. I was a program manager for the last part of my career. And I always liked mentoring people. I always liked teaching people. I always liked, writing. We used to write KB articles back in the day, knowledge base articles.
Yeah.
And do training sessions and things like that. And I always enjoyed doing it. And towards the end of my career, I got connected with, or the end of my career at Microsoft, rather, I got connected with a group called TEALS, T-E-A-L-S, Technical Education and Learning in Schools. That was a part of the Microsoft Philanthropies group. That's what it's part of now. And it would bring computer science professionals, computer professionals like myself, into high schools to teach computer science, where you had a teacher who wanted to start a computer science program, but they didn't have the subject matter knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so we would come in as the subject matter experts. They would provide the classroom and all the structure. And, that's what we would do. Within the first month of me basically volunteer teaching at a high school, I was hooked. I went immediately to the local community college, found out what it takes to get a teaching certificate, worked on that, left Microsoft, became a teacher. And now I'm teaching online. And I love it. I love the process of doing it. I love seeing the light bulb moments in my students. I remember when I had those moments when I was learning this stuff, and I desperately want them all to have those where they go, oh, I get it. And then I'm like, yes, job done. So,
yeah, that's a lot of fun. I enjoy seeing that in the people who read my articles, but my daughter is 9 now, so I get to see her have some light bulb moments just with like math so far. And eventually I hope to do that with computer programming too.
Yeah. Yeah, I keep trying it. I have a young cousin. He's 15 or so. And I've tried to expose him to it. He's not that interested. There are a couple of other, some other young high school students that I know from another activity that I do, and trying to gauge their interest as well, because, you know, I think this is kind of the way, mm-hmm. you know, well, it's the way forward that I know, so I can show them that way.
Yeah. And, you know, people say that we might get replaced someday by AI or something, but there's so much things that computer scientists, computer developers, engineers, that we can, there's a ton of things we can still do.
Yeah.
And
I don't think we're going to get replaced by AI, because AI needs some creative source material to draw from. And
exactly.
So, as far as I know, AI hasn't created much yet. It just keeps remixing all the old stuff. So.
Yeah. And I'm like, there's all these new things. Even libraries have STEM classes now for kids and adults. It's just like a never ending thing. And I don't see why people just don't jump in and start learning it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Pays the bills better than a lot of jobs.
This is true. My father, he worked all of his life, you know, manual labor kind of things. He was a truck driver for a long time, forklift operator, things like that. Mm-hmm. And he had told me that he was so, he was not jealous, but he was, you know, he admired the fact that I was able to make a living by not working with my hands and my back and my legs and, you know, ruining mm-hmm. my body, you know, to do things like that. And, you know, I remember telling him, though, I was kind of envious of him, because he knew all of this stuff about building and all this stuff about, you know, working mm-hmm. on cars and putting things together. And I didn't, you know, I could work as, you know, I could tell him how to get some stuff done on his phone, but, you know, he had to tell me how to, you know, change the plumbing in my house. And so,
Yeah, same here. And another thing about you mentioned doing trucking and stuff, a lot of that stuff's outside. You actually get to go out and enjoy the world. Most engineers are stuck indoors, and not everyone, but
yeah. I try to make a point about getting outside. Even when I was working at Microsoft, I tried to make a point about getting outside every now and then. So
yes.
And if you're there long enough, you get a window office, so at least you get to see what the outside looks like that you're missing. So.
Yeah. I do like that so many companies now, they give you an area, like a walking area outside or outdoor lunch areas now.
Yeah.
So it's getting better.
Yeah, Microsoft campus is huge too. I mean, you know, I would take every chance I had. If I had a meeting in another building, I'd look at it and go, okay, it's going to take me about 20 minutes to get there. I'll just leave a half hour early and I'll walk over there. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's super good. Good for your health and good for your state of mind too.
Yes.
So anyway, let's get back to Python. How'd you get into Python? We didn't even talk about that yet.
Yeah. Actually, I got into Python because of the Teals teaching. One of the courses that we were teaching the students, the first part of the course was Snap. It was Snap. Okay. So a block programming language from MIT based on Scratch. It's, you know, you move blocks around on the screen and make things. And I mean, it's a first class programming language. You can do everything in it. I've seen people do the advent of code in Scratch, which is cool. You know, incredible. And so the first semester was going to be Scratch. And so I had to learn that, but that didn't take long. And then the second part was going to be Python. And I didn't know Python. So, okay, I got to learn it. If I'm going to teach it, I got to learn it. So I sat down mm-hmm. and started learning it. And I started using things like, what was it called? Euler problems. What is site? I'm going to have to look it up. I can't remember it now.
But Project Euler?
Yeah, Project Euler. That's it. Thank you. Project Euler. And so it's a bunch of math problems that are fairly easy to solve, you know, if you know how to code. And so I thought, okay, well, I can solve these problems in, you know, C or C sharp or any of the other languages I know. Let me try and do it in Python. That way I can learn how Python works. And mm-hmm. that's how it started. So, you know, the first semester, you know, I'm learning Python about a week ahead of the kids just to make sure that I know what's going on. And so that turned into, you know, once I got more comfortable with it and a lot more familiar with it, that's when I started writing. That's actually where I met Dan Bader at Real Python. He was looking for people to write. And I thought, well, I know Python well enough, and I know how to write, and I know how to teach. Maybe I'll go there. And that was the start of the whole thing. So, and that's kind of blossomed into this whole, now I teach Python at Coding Nomads as well. So
that's really cool. So do you have any like favorite Python packages or modules?
I do. You know, like I said, I started learning to code to write games. And so two of my favorite Python packages are Arcade and Pygame. So Pygame's been around forever. But Arcade is relatively new. It takes a more modern kind of structured approach, more along the lines of if you've ever, you know, coded in Unity, written games in Unity or Godot. And, you know, just basically said, okay, we've got this whole framework. All you need to do is hook into these little, you know, the on runs, the on plays, you know, the on mouse moves, things like that. Mm-hmm. Arcade set up in much the same way. So you can architect your game and have this basically built-in framework that'll handle things like sprite management and backgrounds and, you know, scrolling backgrounds and parallax and things like that. So, yeah, so those are probably my two favorites. My third favorite I'm going to throw in there is the anti-gravity package, because I've always wanted to fly. And I keep importing it, but it keeps not letting me fly. But anyway. Yeah.
Is Arcade based on Pygame or is it completely separate?
No, it's a completely separate engine. It actually uses a different back end. It's using, is it using OpenGL? It uses a different back-end framework to render the graphics for you. And so I know it won't run, at least at the time that I was really heavy into it, it wouldn't run on an RPi because the graphic framework wasn't back there. And so, and it's all very much object-based and class-based, as in you have to create your own classes. Okay. You know, but Pygame's kind of the same way, but you can write straight-up procedural Python in Pygame without ever having to touch, you know, make your own classes. Arcade, you really can't. You've got to make a class, and you've got to, you know, if you're going to have sprites, you're going to derive your own sprites and such. So, from their sprite class. So,
Interesting. Yeah. I haven't played with Arcade at all. Or really any of the gaming libraries. They're on my list of things to learn.
Yeah. Well, luckily, about a year or two ago, I wrote an article on Arcade, and I've got an article on Pygame, and I've got another article on some other gaming engines, depending upon what you like. So, you know, I know there are a lot of people out there who like the kind of Zork type of games. There's a great engine called Adventure Live that does those really well. So,
Nice. Are you aware of any Python gaming ones that does 3D, even halfway decent, or is it just mainly 2D?
I don't do a lot of 3D stuff. The two that I looked at Panda 3D, and there was another one called Ursina that I looked at for a little bit. But I don't have a lot of 3D. It's not the kind of thing that I wanted to really delve into, so I never really dove in hard to it. But those are the two that I had looked at as far as 3D to gaming goes. So.
Okay. Well, when you mentioned OpenGL, I know it does 3D, but I didn't think Arcade did 3D, so I thought I'd just ask.
No, at this point, yeah, the last time I checked, Arcade doesn't do 3D, so.
Okay. I don't really care. I still like the 2D games, so it's all good. Yeah. So when you go to, like, write an article or maybe even teach a topic, how do you decide what you're going to write about or teach about?
So one of the things that I did, I started a blog of my own because one of the things that I noticed at Coding Nomads is Coding Nomads is set up so that you can, you know, teach yourself how to code. And there are a lot of people who want to make the switch from whatever they're doing to be a coder and to be able to work wherever they want and, you know, make more money.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I noticed is okay, so you know about if statements and you know about for loops and you know about variables and you know about data types and such, but you know, how are you going to store data? You know, how are you going to put the data in a file? Like if you want to write mapping software, if you want to write something that does something like what Waze or Google Maps does, how do you store that data? How do you do the searches from point A to point B? How do you figure out what's the best way to get there? Well, these are fairly typical computer science things, you know, graph searches, breadth first search, depth first search, you know, storing things in graphs, storing things in trees, or even like a spell checker, you know, you want to store data in tries and do different things. But these are not things that you learn when you're learning to code. You're learning how to do, you know, the basics. So that to me has always been, you know, kind of on the edge between what it is that you're learning from a boot camp situation or a self-taught situation, and what it is that I learned in computer science, and how do we get from, you know, how do I bridge that gap? And so I'm always looking at where that gap is. It's also a lot of the things that I put up there are things that I've tried to do that I've either had problems with, or I had to look something up, or I had to try and figure something out. And then it's a matter of, okay, I want to write this out. I want to make sure A, that I don't lose it. I want to make sure it's there. And that it is, you know, and that it's also there for other people, you know, so maybe somebody else has done this. I had an issue like that where my computer, there was a power outage. My computer kind of crapped out of me. I had to go figure out what was going on. I needed to do a BIOS update. Well, it wouldn't do the BIOS update. I have a Linux machine, not a Windows machine. The BIOS updates are Windows executables. I can't just run it on my Linux machine. I've got to take that and, you know, get the BIOS code out of it and go into the BIOS and update it that way. Well, there was no easy, I couldn't figure out how to do it. It kept giving me this weird error. And I went looking to try and find out, okay, who else has had this error? Well, apparently I was only the second person ever who's had this problem, because I only found one other person who did have it. And they couldn't figure it out either. And so I just started digging into the BIOS and started looking for all these little things. And I finally found this one little setting that turned off, I had to turn on Secure Boot again and turn on something else, BIOS Guard, in order to get the BIOS to actually update itself. Just the nature of the error kind of led me down this path. And so I made those changes in the BIOS, did the BIOS update, then I had to undo them all, because then Linux wouldn't boot with those on. Because the Linux kernel wouldn't get past the, you know, the BIOS guard and all the other stuff, because it was originally a Windows machine.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so it's okay, I dug into this. Now let's write all this stuff down, so the next time I have to do a BIOS update, I don't have to go search it out again. And then I decided, okay, well, this would make a good blog article too. So, you know, I'm going through a lot of my notes, going through a lot of the problems that I've gone through, all the stuff that I've written down, and said, okay, I think this would be a decent, you know, 3 to 5 minute read, might be useful to somebody at some point in time. Let's put it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how I write some of my articles. I'm like, well, I learned something new today. Time to write it down so I don't forget it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We used to do that when I was at Microsoft and I wrote KB articles. It was the same way. I'm, you know, a customer would call in with a problem. And I would help them solve through the, you know, work through the problem, and we'd work it out. And then I'd have all these notes as to what it is that we did. And I said, you know what, if I put this in a KB article, I don't have to talk to somebody else again. They don't have to call us in. They don't have to burn one of their support calls. They can just go and look it up in the KB. So,
nice.
You know, so I'd write that stuff out. So that's kind of carried me through, you know, 25, 30 years later, just, you know, whatever problems I have, write them down and maybe somebody else will have them.
Yeah. Well, I salute you. I'm always looking for those people who've taken the effort to write down not just the question and the problem, but how to fix the problem too. So, yeah, I do the same thing. I'm like, well, I know I'm going to have this problem again in a year. Let's put this up here. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It saved me a couple times too, because I sat there and wrote down all the steps I need to do to set up my machine the way I like it. You know, all the different, you know, where did I download the theme that I'm using? Where did I get all the fonts that I use? You know, how did I set up my SQL thing correctly in Docker? How did I get Plex set up so that it talks to everybody else? You know, my TV can talk to it and such. So I went and just wrote down all those steps, you know, stick them in my notes. And now, you know, the next time I had to reinstall my machine, which sadly I've had to do like twice in the past 6 months. Okay, I've got it. I can just go through the notes again and we're good.
Yeah. What I find funny about posting those kind of notes online is, you know, I'll go do a Google search and I'll find my own article. I'm like, what? I knew how to do this 2 years ago. I've forgotten it all now.
Oops.
Yeah.
Hey, this sounds exactly like the problem. Oh, man.
Yeah. It's kind of like blame when you go into Git and you're like, man, who wrote this crappy code?
Yeah, exactly.
It was me.
Okay. I'll take the walk of shame for that one. Okay.
Yeah. So have you found any concepts harder to teach than others? Or?
One of the things that most recently that I found, and this is part of the reason why I started the blog, And it's going to sound stupid. Why do array indexes in Python and in C and in Java and a couple other languages? Why do array indexes start at zero and not at one? Mm-hmm. Because when we start counting at one, not at zero. Yep. And there's a very simple answer to it. But knowing the simple answer relies upon so much knowledge under the surface. You need to know how memory mm-hmm. is laid out. You need to know how things are stored in memory and how the different programming languages access those things that are stored in memory. To understand why you start at zero, it's a simple math thing. It's just easier to calculate based on zero than it is on one, but other languages do it on one. So I sat down and, you've heard of rubber duck debugging, right? Mm-hmm. Where you sit there and you try and explain a tough problem to a rubber duck. And so as I was writing this, as I was sitting down trying to write this out, I'm talking to my rubber duck, and I've got two or three of them hanging around here. And as I kept talking it through, I kept trying to get to simpler and simpler concepts that I could actually explain. And I wound up, basically having a series of about 8 or 9 different things that I knew that I could write about. But that is a lot just to get there. So that's part of what spurred on the blog post to explain some of this stuff. But it's also, just trying to boil down that one simple thing into its constituent mm-hmm. parts is really tough. And so just making sure, just about any concept where I'm not sure if somebody has got the basis for the knowledge I'm about to impart is mm-hmm. is tricky. I can tell anybody, if you were to, make this variable this instead of this up there, it'll work. How do I know that? Trying to get back to some commonality at the bottom is always tough. And so basically it's any concept that I'm not sure if the reader or the student has the base knowledge that I have. I'm trying to get them to the same level as I am.
Yeah.
And so trying to make sure that they've got the same base as I do. And I was listening to the podcast with Anthony Shaw, and his bit on simplifying and explaining things, it just resonated with me when I was talking or when I was listening to him, mm-hmm. and sitting there thinking, you asked me how I pick the things I write about. Well, one of them is to teach it. The other one is so that I understand it better.
Yeah.
And in the course of writing this whole thing on why array indexes start at zero, I found that I started to really grok a lot better how all this stuff kind of builds up from, a bunch of ones and zeros at the bottom to, mm-hmm. Mario running across the screen, and jumping over a mushroom. So.
Yep. It's always going back to the basic precepts. It's like, learning your ABCs and your 1, 2, 3s, you need to know those to understand the higher levels.
Yeah. It helps too that, my wife is not a coder. She's smart as a whip, but she's not a coder. And so sometimes I'll use her as my quote unquote rubber duck. And I will try to explain a problem that I have to her. And sometimes I'm explaining it to her just like I would a rubber duck, and I get it. I get the answer. But sometimes she'll just say something like, well, why don't you do this? And mm-hmm. I'll say, well, no, that's stupid. You can't do that. And then I'll go, wait a minute. No, that's not stupid. I can do that. And, so she'll give me just from her listening to me and giving me some feedback and, being intelligent herself, she'll come up with something for me that I can go use. So, and if I can explain it to her in a way that makes sense, then I know that I can probably explain it to my students as well. So,
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I my wife is much the same way. She's smart in her own way, her own bailiwick, her own areas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she's a lawyer. Well, not a lawyer. She's a paralegal, but she's very well versed in law and legal theory and things like that. So, and more power to her, because I don't get it at all.
Yeah, totally get it. Yep. So, as a teacher and for Coding Nomads, do you have to keep current in tech? And if you do, how do you do that?
I do. If I want, so we teach a lot of different tracks. I came on as a Java and a Python mentor just for straight, you know, kind of intro Java and intro Python. But we've got tracks on using Django and Flask to build websites in Python. We've got a track on data science and machine learning. And we have a track on using Spring for Java and building big Spring apps. And so keeping current on those, if I wanted to, I can mentor folks in Flask because I went through the Flask course and I learned Flask. So, okay, now I've got, there are students who come on who want to learn Flask. I can help with that. I picked up Spring towards the end of last summer. And so now when we have a Spring student, I'll be, confident enough to tutor them, mentor them in Spring. And I'm always going through the curriculum and looking at the curriculum and looking at the things, the problems that students are having and asking myself, okay, if they're having this issue, should we go back and update the curriculum? What else do we need to teach? Should we rearrange mm-hmm. things, do things earlier? So yeah, I keep up with tech as far as that goes, but there's also like my own things that I like to learn. I've done, and I don't know if you've participated or not, I've done the Advent of Code for years, since I started teaching, high school back in 2018.
Okay.
So Advent of Code, it runs in December, December 1st through the 25th, you get two problems a day. You can solve them any way you want. You get a description of the problem. Here's your input. What's the output? And you can solve it in any way that you want. I've solved them using Excel spreadsheets before. If you can write it all out on a piece of paper and do it that way, do it that way.
Yeah.
So this year, for the past couple of years, I've used that to learn new languages. That's one of the ways I tested myself on Python. Okay, can I do Advent of Code in Python? I've picked up more advanced Java by doing it in Java. This past year, I decided I was going to learn Rust. It looked like an interesting language. I kind of cut my teeth on, after Pascal, the next real language I learned was C. Rust has kind of got that feel of C. So I decided I wanted to try and learn Rust. So I did Advent of Code in Rust. And so all of these different things, it's my own... I want to keep current. I don't want to fall behind. I don't want to get so far out of step that, somebody's telling me something. I'm like, well, I remember back in the day when we used to use Pascal, we didn't need memory safety. We always knew not to, so things like that. I don't want to get so far out of date that, I'm completely out of it. So. So Rust is a relatively new language. Looks like it's gaining some traction. They're getting Rust into the Linux kernel. So it's a lot of fun to learn. It is tough. It is really a tricky language when you're, especially coming from Python. Python is duck typing, and if you want to add two things together, Python's going to do its best. If you try and add two things together and they're not the exact same data type in Rust, it's going to yell at you. It won't even run. So really trying to get all those little pieces, they're almost diametrically opposite ways of looking at things, but it's, still hone your skills and it's just more learning, which is always good.
Yeah. Yeah, Rust is on my bucket list of something I need to learn.
Mm-hmm. Be ready. Be ready, because they are very, very strict with typing. Very strict with typing. I mean, if you want to add a 16-bit integer to a 32-bit integer, you've got to, there's an extra step in there that you got to do to convert one to the other, because you can't just add them together. Whereas in Python, if you want to, you can add a number to a character and it'll give you something, so.
Yeah, I know. That's funny that way.
Yep.
All right. So have you seen any changes to the way you teach when it comes to using AI?
No, not really. I think I alluded to this earlier, mainly because I haven't used AI. I'm the one person that I know in this field who I've never logged into any of the GPTs. I've never logged into ChatGPT, never created an account, never consciously used it. I don't use Copilot on GitHub. You know, like I said, I alluded to this before. It's recombining a bunch of old stuff that's out there and not really creating new stuff. It's just remixing the old stuff.
That's true.
And I was recently writing a curriculum for Coding Nomads, and the owner of the company asked me, he said, you know, how much ChatGPT have you used to generate this? And I told him, I said, I haven't used any. This is all me. Mainly because I want to write it. You know, it's not, you know, I don't want it written. I want to write it. I want to create it. And so that's part of it. I think the closest I get to using AI is I've got a couple of Echo devices in my home. And I use them to turn the lights on and turn the lights off and set timers and do things like that. But they're buggy. Yeah. There's a musical group that I like called Arion, the prog metal, prog rock group. And I've asked the Echo, I said, you know, hey, play this music by Arion. And every time I do, it says, okay, I'm playing this by Ariana Grande. I was like, no, cancel. there's a difference.
Yeah.
So it recognizes my voice and it'll pick up the words, but it doesn't understand that, you know, I want something else. And I can't go to it and say, never, ever play, you know, Ariana Grande, never play this, never play that, because I don't want to hear it. You know, and one of your other hosts or one of your other guests a little while ago, Brett, I think he's kind of in the same boat I am. He's a little skeptical of AI. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, yeah, I'm just... I try not to use it. I recognize that my students are there, and you know, I recognize that my students are going to Google things. They're going to look for things. That's fine. I mean, I Google things and look for things too. So, so I'm always, you know, it makes my job as a teacher a little trickier because I have to gauge, you know, I can't just look at the code and say, okay, that's right. I have to actually, you know, start quizzing them and asking them, okay, you know, start kind of poking around at their understanding of it. It's like, did you just, you know, you're just parroting this back, or, you know, what are you doing? So.
No, maybe that's the question I'm looking for then is, are you finding students are trying to give you ChatGPT generated stuff rather than doing it themselves?
You know, if they are, I haven't seen it. Well, I may have seen it a couple of times with one or two of my students where the code that they show me is very much more advanced than what it is that, you know, I would have expected from them. Mm-hmm. However, I can't sit there and say, okay, this is AI generated, because they have access to other resources. They have the same access to Stack Overflow that I do. You know, they can go copy code, and it, you know, a couple of them actually have, you know, family members or whatever who are, you know, programmers who work in the industry. We could have asked them for help too. So I can't, you know, I can't point it and say this is AI. You know, it's probably better that we're not, you know, that I'm not teaching them how to write, you know, English literature, you know, write essays and such, because then it'd be a lot tougher. So
Yeah, I just wondered if it was causing. I wonder how much it affects teachers, where they're like, "Well, shoot, do my students really understand this, or are they just, you know, kind of cribbing the test in a way?"
Yeah, one of the good things about Coding Nomads is I have one-on-ones with students. That's how I interact with them. You know, we have dedicated chat channels, but once a week we actually get on and do these kind of voice chats. And so, you know, we'll go through the problems that they've run into. We'll go through the exercises that they've done. And so I have an opportunity to actually do this kind of quizzing of them directly one-on-one to find out where they are. When I was teaching in a high school classroom, I've got 25 kids ahead of me, and I can't quiz each and every one of them. You know, so plus, you know, when I was teaching the classroom, it was pre-GPT, and we were worried more about plagiarism than we were about anything. So, you know, just cut and pasted code. So, you know, I think I'm in a good position where I can actually check for understanding. I could see where if you're in a bigger classroom, it's going to be a little bit tougher to do. So, but I think, you know, as you go along, especially if you're going to try and make a living at this, if you're going to try and turn this into a career, I think it's a worse idea to do that, because at some point in time, you're going to get to a position where ChatGPT or AI is not going to be able to help you. You're going to have to come up with the creative solution on your own. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's a cheap way out. But of course, you know, if you're looking for a grade, then you're looking for a grade.
True enough. Well, let's pivot and talk about something completely different. What's your favorite non-tech hobby, and why do you like it so much?
My favorite non-tech hobby. So I build models, plastic model figures, cars, planes, things like that. You know, I tend to stay away from modern military stuff. I don't do, you know, modern jets or, you know, even World War One, World War Two things, but, you know, ancient historical things, you know, fantasy figures, civilian vehicles, rescue craft, things like that. So all different scales, all different whatever. I enjoy the focus. I enjoy, you know, basically putting on my headphones, popping on a podcast, and just sitting there and painting or building. Mm-hmm. Or constructing something, and in a working on computers all day, writing and creating, content or writing code or anything. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have something to do with your hands. You know, something that is gonna, something that will last afterwards. You know, I've got a number of them sitting up here on my desk, and some out in a display case, and there are some in I've given to other people and such. And, you know, when I turn the computer off, nobody knows what I've done, but I can point to each of these things and said, I did that. And they will, they will outlast me after, when I die, then it'll be up to somebody else to throw them away. But, so we've had that. And, there's kind of the side, there's kind of these adjacent hobbies that go along with it. There's 3D printing, some 3D design work. I've done a little bit of each. There's the historical research on things too. If you're going to make something that you want to be accurate, well, you've got to do some digging. You've got to do some research. So there's, books and magazine articles and all sorts of searches I do on, parts of history. And so by learning these things, you also start to dig into, this is some interesting part of history that I never knew about. I learned that a close friend of mine is big into there are Civil War reenactors in different places and Revolutionary War reenactors. Well, he does like French and Indian War reenactment. So, mid 18th century kind of things. And I didn't know this about him until we started talking about it. And, his enthusiasm was infectious. So now I'm looking at, doing subject matter from that period of history and learning more about that period of history that I didn't know. You learn about all these different little things that you maybe never would have known about. So really the only other hobby I have is my wife and I both play in two concert bands. So she's a flautist. I play bass clarinet, and we do that. And we've got a big concert coming up for the Eclipse that's coming through this area.
Oh, nice. Is that like classical music or jazz or?
It's a concert band. If you remember like high school concert bands, stuff. These are community bands. They play the same kind of music, pseudo classical, poppy kind of stuff, marches and what have you. Actually she and I met at a concert band. That's where we first laid eyes on each other. And so, it's kind of fun. So if I'm not, if I'm not sitting here writing, or, building a model or painting something, then, I'm usually, practicing trying to get better.
Yeah. That's cool. That's really awesome. Well, I just want to thank you so much for being on my show today, John, and I hope y'all consider coming back on someday.
I certainly will. Yeah. When I get, hopefully I'll have something more Python-y that I can contribute.
We cover lots of Python stuff. It's all good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again. And I'll include some links to some of John's works in the show notes so everyone else can go check out your awesome work.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hit subscribe and don't miss the next episode.
Mike Driscoll, The Python Show.